Welcome, everyone. This is December 7th. We begin our celebration of the enlightenment of Shakyamuni Buddha. Now, the official dates for this on some calendars actually climax on December 8th, which is tomorrow. Some groups will have what they call Rahatsu, which is just a Japanese word to say, I think it's the 12th month on the 8th. And basically they'll begin sesshin or retreats that begin about a week before. Being a lay community, what we tend to do is we tend to start around the 8th and then we'll go to like a week later, around the 14th or 15th. This year we'll because of the changes that have occurred and all the different things going on in the world, we've adjusted our schedule to that. So we're going to begin the Satori season tonight, and then we will have our ceremony, our larger ceremony, on Saturday, 6:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and we will live stream from the House of Meditation. So that's what we're doing now. And I will offer some practices for this week, especially because of this time of year. And we'll kind of go into that a little bit more. But let's continue with the Ask Sensei Tony series. And the question that I received from someone last week is, Dear Sensei Tony, how do I find peace in an uncertain world? So the quote tonight is actually attributed to the Buddha Shakyamuni, and it's from a text called the Dhammapada. Better than 1,000 useless words is one useful word, hearing which one attains peace. So that's a big question. How do I find peace in an uncertain world? So to begin my talk, I'm going to share with you another passage which is located in the sutras and attributed to the Buddha, Shakyamuni. And this is a tough one. There are certain sayings by the Buddha, you read them and it's like, oh yeah, that makes sense. It's just straightforward. And then there are other ones that require a bit more contemplation because they have a very deep meaning. And sometimes the initial reading is not as clear. But here it is. If one thinks he insulted me, he struck me, he cheated me, he robbed me, as long as we have those thoughts, we will not find peace. If we can give up such thoughts entirely, we will find peace. I think that's a tough passage, right? How does one understand that? And so in order for us to do that, I'm going to offer a few more things that we'll kind of come back to. And I think once I kind of share this other information, hopefully that'll explicate it and make it a little clearer. So when someone asks me a question like that, how do we find peace in an uncertain world? So the first thing that I would say to that is, what is a certain world? Like when someone says to me, you know, living in times of uncertainty, or, you know, living in an uncertain world, my thought is, what's certain? What about this? There's the old word for it in the Buddhist text is saha. In this saha world, what is certain? Now, we sometimes get lulled into certainty because we get into habits and we get into routines and things seem to go from one to the other. But the reality is, it's always uncertain. We live in the illusion that there's certainty. But there is no certainty. You might have certainty that you will go from here, let's say, and you're going to walk up to the second floor of the house of meditation. You didn't know you were going to trip. You didn't know you were going to hurt your leg. Right? There was nothing in your mind that said, well, it's certain. Every time I go up those steps, nothing will happen to me. And then one time you do, and there it is. We think that life is certain, but there's nothing certain about this life. Absolutely nothing. And some of us know that better than others, but I think a lot of people live under the illusion that there can be some kind of certainty that you can hold on to, and that that'll make everything okay. I know of nothing like that in this world. Nothing. And in fact, the expression Saha, S-A-H-A, Saha world, can be translated as, this is the world where we must bear things. We have to bear the pain of living. We have to bear the pain of birth. We have to bear the pain of death. And we have to bear the pain of all the things that happen to us in between. And so for me, that resonates. I understand this is a Saha world. It's uncertain. And using this person's question, which is a good question, how do I find peace in an uncertain world? The first thing that we have to do is we have to be clear that peace will never come from an uncertain world. It just won't happen. And yet that's what most people do. They try to find ways to make the world as certain as they can, and they spend a lot of their time trying to make that happen, and then in a New York minute, everything changes. And then there they are with the uncertainty. And then they feel the peace is fleeting. And of course, if the peace that you're seeking comes from the world, well, good luck. Because I have, what's the old world? I always like to quote lyrics, Billy Idol, White Wedding. There is nothing sure in this world. There is nothing fair in this world. Nothing. Tell me something that's fair. There is nothing certain and nothing fair in this world. So if we want peace, it's not going to come from trying to manipulate that. Because whatever kind of peace that is, it will be fleeting and short-lived, man. It won't last. So how does the Buddha address this? How do we address this as practitioners? Well, we start from a different place. First of all, by recognizing that we live in this Saha world. And that it is a place where we bear the burden of being alive. But there is something else that we can do, another type of bearing. And that's something we call bearing witness. We can bear witness to reality. And it begins by recognizing this Saha world. Now, when we wish to find that peace that exists even within an uncertain world, there's a certain way to approach this. Because the experience of this world, it's just the karma of consciousness. One of the things that drew me to this tradition was that it didn't try to answer every question in a way that seemed almost childlike, right? Why is this? Well, because of that. But rather, what it did was it sort of said, you know, this is life. This is what it is. There's nothing behind, you know, it's not like, what is it, the Wizard of Oz. There's nothing behind the curtain. This is just what it is. When we plant a seed in the ground, and that seed grows into a tree, like a pine tree, you know, I love pine trees. And of course, during this time of the year, we celebrate the pine tree. And in the Zen tradition of Buddhism, the pine tree is a symbol of the eternal. It's woven into the cases that they wear, a sprig of the pine. But you think about it, right? It grows from this tiny, tiny thing into this magnificent structure. And the process of that, from the time that the seed falls until the time that it grows into this majestic carnivorous, that's just how it is. That's life. And humans are the same way. We're just like the tree. There is life, and this is how it unfolds. It's a little different for us because our consciousness is different. Our self-awareness is different. At least, I think so. I've never spoken to a tree. But we have a self-awareness, a type of self-consciousness that makes it a little different for us. But that's our understanding. Our understanding is that this life is just the karma or cause of consciousness come into being. Consciousness starts here as a small seed, and then it grows into Buddha. It grows into this universal consciousness. Why it grows that way and how it grows that way, we can understand how, but why? It just is. So when we look at the world, and we call it a saha world, a world of uncertainty, maybe that's not because there's something wrong with the world, but maybe there's something wrong with the way we're seeing the world. So if we begin with our foundation of just saying, this is how it is, just like the seed that grows into the pine tree, the little consciousness that grows into universal consciousness. This is just how it works. Just how it works. And the pain of being self-aware or self-conscious is just part of the growth. Because the growth of anything, in some ways, is painful. Remember when we were kids and people would say, oh, they're just growing pains? Well, there's some truth to that. So there's growing pains when we go from self-consciousness. We go from consciousness, like maybe a tree, to self-consciousness, like a human, to the universal consciousness of a Buddha. Yeah. It can be painful. But part of why we experience it as suffering is not because so much of the there's something wrong with the world or something about the world that needs to be changed. But it's how we're seeing it. So what can we bear witness to? Well, in our practice, we bear witness to the universe. We bear witness to reality. And as we bear witness to reality, starting from a place of not knowing, starting from a place of questioning everything, I mean everything, we bear witness to what we can perceive. We can bear witness to what we might know. And what we discover is that there are three principles and three practices that we can realize. And if we practice those three principles, we will find peace in an uncertain world. We will find peace in this Saha world, because we will begin to see and understand the world in a different way. When we talk about this place of burden, there are three poisons of consciousness or mind that we talk about. And these three poisons are delusion, hatred, and greed. The three principles and the three practices are a way for us to see in a way that we free ourselves from those poisons. The practices and principles are like an antidote to those poisons of the mind. The poisons of the mind that are part of the natural evolution of our consciousness and seeing this as a Saha world. So, the three principles. So the first thing that we understand is delusion. That's the first poison. And what does that mean? Delusion means that we're not seeing things as they are. We're seeing things the way we wish they were. Or we're focusing on what it's not. But we're not seeing it as it is. And we've been conditioned to believe that this sense of separation that we experience through this unfolding of our consciousness from self-consciousness into universal consciousness, that this stage that we go through, we feel very alone, and the world feels very alien to us, and we feel alien in this world. And from this delusion, where we see things as all separate, that suffering arises. However, if we bear witness to what actually is going on, what actually we can know, we discover, or we awaken to the third principle. And what is the third principle? We awaken to the idea of our true self. We awaken to the idea or the concept of our true self. And this true self is our true nature. And that our true nature is not these separate, alienated little bags of skin floating on a speck of dust in an infinite universe. But rather, our true nature, our true calling, is to become Buddha, is to become enlightened, is to become awakened, is to see the oneness of all life and live out of that oneness. And when we do this, the delusion ends, and we see life as it is, an interconnected, wondrous web of life. And you no longer feel separate. And once you really allow this idea to sort of marinate in you, and you test it, and you wrestle with it, and you work with it, you realize that it's real. You can start with a metaphor, you know, and just see how it functions practically. But in the end, you realize it's real. And then my identity is no longer limited to just this experience of this Tony. My experience of life is much larger. Because my true self is the very universe itself, becoming aware, becoming awake. And I no longer identify just with that limited self-consciousness. So that's the first one. We overcome delusion by seeing through our separateness and realize our oneness. The second principle is there to help us to overcome the poison of greed. So what happens from this delusion is we feel we're separate, right? So now if we're separate, we're trying to hold on to things. We're trying to grasp at things. Because, you know, just like wanting things to be certain, we grasp at that. Because if we can't hold on to that, we're just these separate beings. And it's just, the suffering is immense. And so we get greedy. We're never really satisfied. There's never enough to make us feel whole. There's never enough to give us that sense of peace in this uncertain world. And greed sometimes, you know, is easy to see. And we do it in our stories, like at Christmas time. My favorite story is The Christmas Carol. And we talk about, you know, Scrooge and his greed. And that's one that's kind of easy to look at and see. But it can be more subtle than that. Part of my greed can just be this sense, quoting another song by Judas Priest, we are never satisfied. You know, we're always looking for something else to do it, when everything that we need is within us. And that's what we realize through the first principle, the third principle of realization of our true self. And I think of the second principle related to greed. The second principle of oneness is about how we work with change, how we work with the uncertainty, and how we can become creative, and how new things only come into being when we are living out of that second principle. And that's how I believe we overcome greed, because we learn to take care of the ego self. The ego self is no longer the enemy. The ego self is no longer the center of the universe either. It's no longer, ironically, the separate alienated aspect, and it's no longer the center of everything either. It's just an experience that I'm having, and one that I love sometimes. Sometimes the experience of this ego self is unpleasant. But the experience of Tony, which began in 1963 and will end somewhere out here, hopefully a long time, that's just one experience. That's not the total, it's not the whole. And you don't have to even be spiritual to believe that. There's a theory by a scientist named Robert Lanza called the theory of biocentrism. And he has a new work out, which is his idea of how consciousness helps us to create a grand unified theory of everything. And it was before Lanza. He's just taking different insights from others and bringing them together. And they say the same thing. They say that essentially this experience of this life is one experience. And it's sort of like when you binge watch your favorite show, right? My wife and I do that regularly. We just finished J.K. Rowling's mystery series, Strike. Is that what it was called? Strike. It was very good. She wrote it under a pseudonym, Robert Gilbreth. And then, you know, it was revealed that it was J.K. Rowling, and it's really good. And it's a detective series, one of our favorite things. But there's only three books, so there's only three seasons. So we watched it, and we're done. And now you're waiting for the next book to come out, if there is another book, and another season. And that's the way it is. But that's how I look at this life. This is a series I'm in. This is a movie I'm in. It's cool. It's fun. I love it. I'm totally there. But I know that ultimately I'm like an actor. And this is a role that I'm playing. It's not the only one I ever play, and it won't be the only one I ever play. And so I don't have to be greedy, and I can take care of myself because I know that I'm not a separate being, and I know this isn't the whole story. And so it stops me from the frantic grasping. And I can rest knowing that I live in this larger, boundless identity. And so this story, this role that I'm playing, I love it. That's not the only one. And according to some physicists, there's a lot of other ones going on at the same time right now. All little variations, like I'm here tonight, and another one, I'm not here, I'm somewhere else. But they're all that story. It's like those kids' books. You remember those books when you were a kid, or I remember my son was younger, they had different endings. So you read through the main body of the story, and then you could go in different directions. Well, that's what physicists say today. The reality is that our consciousness is always going off in different directions based on each decision we make. So we live in an infinite variety of things. So there's no need. There's no need to rush. There's no need to worry. The founder of the mass-produced automobile, the Ford, great vehicle, founded by Henry Ford. Henry Ford believed in this. And he often said, I don't have to worry about it. If I don't figure it out here, I'll get it next time. So there was a sense that he didn't have to grasp after things. So that's how we overcome greed, by taking care of the ego self, acknowledging what the ego self needs, and teaching it and caring for it so that it can learn to let go of grasping after. And start to understand the natural beauty within. And then the third poison is hatred. Now, hatred occurs when the delusion, which creates the greed, and we can't get what we need, we think, although quoting another song, you can't always get what you want, but you can get what you need. But we're always grasping after what we want. And when we can't get it, because we think we don't have enough, we need something outside of ourselves, then we start to hate. Because we see somebody that has something that I think I should have and I don't. Happens all the time to lots of people. And if we're honest, we do it too. We look at someone and we think, oh, wow, I just had what they had. Or we don't think we can get that. And then we're like, I hate them. I hate that. I hate them. And we do. And so what's the antidote? Well, the antidote for that is the first principle of oneness, and that is compassion. That we can learn to care for the ego self of others. To realize that even if someone has something that I think I want, the truth is I don't know what it's like from the inside. I have had the experience as a counselor and teacher of working with people who in our culture had it made. They were attractive, they had money, and they had fame. And remarkably, in spite of those things, they saw this as a Saha world. They suffered. And, you know, it's hard, right? So one day I might be working with someone who's homeless, and the next day I'm working with someone who has 10 homes. But it doesn't matter, because the suffering that each of those are experiencing is coming from the same place. It's coming from the same delusion, coming from the same greed, coming from the same hatred. But we can learn to see that even if you seem very different from me, our common denominator is the suffering the neurosis that's created by these delusions. And so I can care for you, even if I don't like you, because in our tradition, compassion is an action. It's not a feeling or an emotion. It's a recognition of the clarity that all beings are suffering. We suffer for the same reasons because of the same delusions. And that our suffering is what really makes it easy for us to see our oneness with each other. And it's hard to do that sometimes when people seem very different from us. But when we realize that we all suffer exactly the same way, then that allows us to care for them, to wish them to be free from their suffering. And it allows us to connect to people that are very different from us in a very real way. So there are three practices related to these three principles. The first practice is the practice of what we call precept. And this is the power and freedom of intention that comes from this idea of compassion and action. When I'm practicing precept, what I'm realizing is that I can let go of things I don't intend. In other words, I'm no longer responsible for something that I didn't consciously intend. And that's a big deal, a really big deal. Because when you sit with someone and you do counseling with them and stuff like that, you find out that most people, they really are taking responsibility for things that they have no control over. And they had no intention around. Now, this might not work for a sociopath, but for the other 99% of the human race, this is how it works. We take responsibility for things we didn't intend. And one of the things that's beautiful about the precepts is that I learned to only take responsibility for the things I intend. I don't have to take responsibility for any of those. Now, that doesn't mean I don't care, right? I can still show compassion, but it doesn't require me to feel anything. It doesn't require me to think, oh, that's my fault, or oh, that's my responsibility. It makes it very clear for me that if I did not intend something, and I consciously contemplated it, and that was not my intention, I am not responsible. I can care compassionately, but I'm not responsible anymore. And just try that as a practice during this Holy Week. Look at something that comes up that hooks you, where you feel you're responsible. And then examine it to see if your intention is clear. And if you realize through that practice that this had nothing to do with your intention, and that you're not really responsible for it. Just sit with that. Sit with how that is. Sit with that new thought and that new belief and see how you experience it. My experience of it is a sense of freedom and a new sense of power, the power of my intention. The second practice is the practice of mindfulness. And this is by creating clarity. And the practice that I recommend, and if you haven't been practicing with us or our Sangha, I recommend the Four Directions System of Mindfulness book. Dig into it, contact us, and we'll teach you and help you go through it. But there's a practice in there called the Four Questions. Four Questions of Mindfulness. And so as a way of practicing around the idea of mindfulness, all I would like to offer or suggest is that, again, if you don't know the Four Questions, we can teach it to you. But if you know, as many, many, many of you do, try practicing the Four Questions even when you're not really hooked by something. even when it's something smaller. Because I promise you, if you do the four questions and you follow that mindfulness process, you will experience peace. You will experience that peace, which we call nirvana. You will have a taste of it. And anytime you're feeling that way, anytime that you feel things are out of whack, do the four questions. And even when things aren't out of whack, and it's something minor, do the four questions. Because doing that process trains your mind to become your ally. And it allows you, as you go through it, to experience that sense of peace that transcends the condition. And finally, there's the practice of meditation. And this is the practice of abiding beyond change. And that's how I view meditation ultimately. For me, meditation is connecting with my true self, or the true self. And so when I practice meditation, as we abide, and we'll spend some time tonight doing that, I just allow myself to be embraced by my true nature, by my true self. And I let little Tony in the embrace of Big Tony. And that's how I experience sitting. And so it's blissful. And it allows me a way anytime I want, anytime during the day, to just draw in and allow myself to abide in the oneness of my true self. So, there you have it. So how do you find peace in an uncertain world? By waking up to those three principles, carrying out those three practices. And you will have peace within an uncertain world. You will have that peace, as some would say, surpasses all understanding. It transcends all the condition of the ego self. And I will give you three other things along with those practices to kind of think about this week, which will culminate on Saturday night. And that is, think of life as something where you try to live a little more simply. In other words, try to really appreciate the littlest, easiest things in your life. And really appreciate them. Like tonight, we're going to do the greeting of the temple, and we'll make hot chocolate. And for me, having a nice cup of hot chocolate, being with my loved ones, doing the greeting of the temple, and it's bliss for me. But it's simple. It's not hard to get. Secondly, give yourself time for study and devotion. Take time to practice. We get so busy that we forget. But take time each day to practice. Because then you're saying, I am in control. Not everything else, because I'm taking the time to practice, because I know if I take the time to practice, I'm going to benefit. And so no matter what's going on in my day, no matter what's going on in my life, I get to decide how my life goes. And try it by giving yourself at least one time a day where you just devote yourself to study, meditation, just time for yourself. And finally, service. There's an old saying that happiness comes not so much from what we do for ourselves, but what we do for others. And there's some truth to this. New studies in the brain and neurology show that dopamine reward centers in the human brain grow vastly through service to others, through caring about others. And the things that we do for ourselves shrink those, ironically, right? So think about, especially in this time of the year where so many spiritual traditions are celebrating in one way or another the light of love and wisdom. Try just this week, if another time, ask yourself, how could I serve someone else today? How can I help someone else? And see how. So for the person that asked that question, I hope that was helpful.